I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hello, Gary.
Hello, Guy. So we have our first dame. Oh, well, actually, it's not really, is it? Because you're probably you're a dame, aren't you? A bit of a dame.
Pantomime dame.
And of course, if we could have ever got Bowie on,
was
the dame.
Yeah, exactly. Right. But yes, a dame, a genuine cultural icon. As memorable a part of the sort of British iconography of the 60s as the Beatles, Bobby Charlton,
an E-type Jag, and of course the year she took off was the year we won the World Cup, 1966. England was everywhere and everything, and she sort of hit the crest of a wave, didn't she? And became the sort of the figure that, as you said, the figure that represented English swinging London, and British culture. Her name was obviously Leslie Hornby, but people will know her better as Twiggy. And I recently spoke to her, actually. I did her podcast, Tea with Twiggy. And she's absolutely... And I've known Twiggy for a while, but
she
have you ever met her?
I've never met her. So I'm quaking in my boots here.
Okay, should we get
desperate to make a good impression.
Welcome to the Raconteurs.
Okay, guys, I'm ready.
That's a big tune for sure. I actually wrote that originally for Tina Turner.
Of course, I had gone and found Joni Mitchell down in Florida and brought her back.
I've listened to a few of them and they've been really good, man. I'm sitting in the back of the car coming into London. They're brilliant.
That caused a big problem in the band, actually. I was having too much fun.
Thank you guys for still being around, still making music, still being into it, and doing this podcast. It's fabulous.
Well, I get the feeling that us three should go for a pint. That's what I think.
I'm in a band now. It's called Roxy Music.
You know this thing about the 10,000 hours of experience?
Oh, yeah.
And you get good at something. When we recorded Arnold Lane, we'd done about 50 hours.
The Raconteurs Podcast with Gary Kemp and Guy Pratt.
Keep on rocking!
Yeah!
Hey, Twigs.
Oh, God, I hate technology. Isn't it horrible?
It's the worst. Well, it means we can do this.
Hello.
Hello, I'm Twigs.
Hi, Twigs, I'm Guy.
Nice to meet you.
Very nice to meet you.
Your house looks lovely, doesn't it?
Oh, we've been here for 38 years, and that's the same wallpaper as when we moved in. So we reckon this wallpaper is probably 50 years old, but it's lovely.
You're sucking a sweet. So I'm just saying, you haven't got a speech impediment. You're just sucking a sweet.
No, I've got a fisherman's friend.
Oh, well, you can come on as well if you like.
So is Gary. He's called Sven. Okay, Twiggy, I'm sorry. I haven't met you before, and this may be the only chance I get, so I would like to ask you a question.
Go on, then.
Would you like that I should wash the dead bugs from the windshield? Do you remember that? Elwood. That was his line to you in the Blues Brothers.
Was it?
Yes.
Oh, my God. I wouldn't have known that in a million years.
Damn, that was... Oh, well.
Is that what he said to me?
Yeah, it's just a great one. Would you like that I should wash the dead bugs off the windshield?
That's really funny.
He probably wasn't there when she was filming her bit, though, Guy.
He was, actually.
Right.
Although we did get... I was meant to shoot... I mean, I was only there for like 3 days. But we were meant to shoot that 2 days earlier, but it had all got pushed back because, bless his heart, John Belushi, they couldn't get him out of the caravan for 2 days.
Yeah, he wasn't well, was he?
Well, he was obviously taking things he shouldn't be taking.
But your acting, it must be said, your acting in that scene is extraordinary, is brilliant because he...
Thank you.
No, because his proposition is so crass. And you go from this like, what did you just say? But just with your face, then you go, well, actually.
I can't remember.
Yeah,
it's
well,
so
he suggests
ago.
You meet him at
what
a
year
motel.
Was that?
It must have been... 1979.
It's such an iconic movie.
Oh, yeah. I was lucky to be in it, quite honestly. There was amazing people in it. It's a lovely one. As I said, I was in it. If you blink, you missed me. But I did it because I loved, you know, at that point, they were huge on Saturday Night Live.
Although we'd never heard of them before the movie, over here, we had no idea.
Oh, you know, see, so I was living in America then. And they were, you know, Saturday Night Live was the, it was a bit like Ready, Steady, Go was to us teenagers in England. But in America in those years, you did not meet and miss Saturday Night Live because it was brilliant.
Live from New York.
It's funny, Twiggy, because you just said, you know, I blink and I miss it. I was hardly in it. And sort of underestimating who you are and your and the icon that you are, it seems to be second nature to you. You don't feel like an imposter, do you? Though?
Me?
Yeah.
An imposter? No.
Do you know what I mean? It's like you underplay yourself.
I'm a human being. I like to live a normal life. And I think if you start getting into that area, we've all seen it happen in kind of, especially in Hollywood. It's not really a happy ending, is it?
Yeah.
I think you've got to keep normal. You've got to keep your feet on the ground. And, you know, my most important thing in my life are my family. I mean, I love my career and I've been very, very lucky to do lots of different things. But the main strength in my life is my family, my husband, my children, now my grandchildren, and they're my rock. And before that, it was my mum and dad and my sisters. And luckily my sisters are still here, but mum and dad have long gone. But they have just lived again, because I don't know whether you know, but Ben Elton has written a musical based on what happened to me.
Yeah, we're going to talk about that.
And my mum and dad feature in that, so it's nice to bring them back.
That is nice. Sorry, because when it all kicked off, because it was all so quick, and you were so young, because didn't you actually, you were still sort of officially living with them through all that, weren't you?
Oh, yeah. I was just 16 when it happened.
So was Gary.
Right,
so
16 and 4 months.
So was Gary for his first two or three albums, weren't you, gal?
I did. I lived at home. I mean, it's what working class people did, you know. They only moved out when they got married.
Yeah, and they got married, like my sisters did, very young. You went to school. We didn't go to university, you know, people from where we lived. And so my other sisters, you know, I think my elder sister left probably at 16 and went in to do a typing course. And then she became a secretary. And my middle sister, again, probably left at 17, 16 and became a hairdresser.
But you talked about keeping your feet on the ground. I mean, when it all blew up so quickly, and we'll go through how that happened in a minute, but it blew up so quickly. Your mum must have been terrified. Was your dad, were they saying, keep, you know, remember your roots? I mean, what was their response?
You're right. It happened so quickly. I mean, it literally did. You know, I mean, I was still at school, and the piece came through various things that happened and led to the haircut.
Yeah.
Which was literally I was going to have my hair cut by this amazing hairdresser called Leonard. And it was going to be for his salon. That's what it was for. It was not meant to be launching me as a model. It was a photograph of his haircut.
What was the salon called? Leonard of...
The House of Leonard.
The House of Leonard.
In Mayfair.
I used to know lots of girls who that's how they got their haircut. They just did pictures for the salon. It was like...
That's
you know,
right. Yeah. So And for me to go into, I mean, the House of Leonard was a house in Mayfair. I'd never been to Mayfair in my life. You know, Neasden is a long way from Mayfair. And I was dumbstruck because it was so posh. And so when he said I'd gone in to have a blow drive to do some test shots. And he came over and said, can I cut your hair? And I was so frightened and nervous. I kind of just laughed. And he said, I want to do a new haircut. And I didn't really want my haircut. I was a mod. And my hair was parted in the middle. But I was too scared to say no. I'm very glad now I didn't say no. Anyway, he cut that. I went back the next day and I was in there for 8 hours. And he cut it and they coloured it and he cut it. And then I went off to this amazing photographer called Barry Latigan, which was Leonard's photographer.
Who's still alive, and Barry Latigan, I think.
He's not very well, but he is still with us, bless his heart. Anyway, I was very lucky again because... You know, there are good photographers and there are bad photographers. Barry happened to be one of the great photographers, especially for beauty shots. And I went to this, he had a studio in Baker Street, and I went on the bus to Baker Street and went in. And, you know, I'd never had my picture taken. I mean, my dad had taken a picture of me on holiday with a brownie.
Yeah.
So I didn't know what to do. And he just stood me in the studio and he just talked to me. He's a very sweet gentleman. And the the kind of very famous now famous photograph of me just looking into camera was taken on that day.
Stunning.
And I went back to school, and then a big fashion journalist called Deirdre McSharry came into the salon to have her hair done, and she saw the picture and said to Leonard, "Oh, I love the haircut. Who's the girl?" And he said, "Oh, she's a schoolgirl, and her nickname's Twiggy because she's so skinny." I got this phone call, well, my mum did, in Neasden, saying would she come up to Fleet Street. I didn't even know where Fleet Street was. Yeah. You know, when in those days you lived in your little area, which I'm sure you did, Gary, as well. Anyway, I went up to there. She interviewed me, and 2 weeks later it was Twiggy, the face of 66, and that day in February, it changed my life.
Because it didn't come out straight away, did it? And your dad...
No, apparently... my dad used to get up every morning and go to the corner shop to get the paper, to get the Daily Express. And he'd come back and say, "No, Leslie." You know, he was from the north. Sorry about my northern accent. He was from Bolton. Good old Bolton. Vernon Kay's from Bolton. He just did that brilliant.
But it was a broadsheet, wasn't it? The Express was a broadsheet then.
Yeah, so it was
paper.
A big, big... inside the whole page spread, just saying Twiggy the face of 66, and you know, it just kicked off from there.
Wow. But who were you thinking you were when you were looking into Barry's camera at that moment? Who was in your head? What person did you want to be? Because that face you have on is so good. I can't believe you're channeling someone or something.
Well, my idol, apart from the Beatles, who, you know, I think every teenage girl was madly in love with the Beatles. Apart from that, it was Jean Shrimpton, who I just thought was the most beautiful creature I'd ever seen. And she was. And I had her, I had the Beatles on my wall and Jean Shrimpton on my wall. So maybe I, you know, it's a long time. It's over 50 years.
But you're a mod. So didn't you have the Small Faces and the Who up there?
I did. I tell you what's funny. My sister had a boyfriend who she then married, and his dad had a greengrocer's, and I used to go and with my sisters to on a Saturday to so she could, you know, he'd see her boyfriend, and there was a grocery boy in there, and he used to tease the, he was a little bit, I was probably 13 14, and he used to tease me. He was a real cocky kind of, "Hello, Leslie," and he teased me, and I used to get really embarrassed. And his name was Keith Moon.
Oh my God.
Was that Wembley?
In Wembley. It was the greengrocers in Wembley. Wow. And I can remember, you know, once I got to know him, he was really nice. And I can remember him saying, "I'm really excited because, you know, I'm in this band and we're going to have a single come out." And it was "I Can't Explain." Yeah,
but that's similar to you, because he was because he was younger than the rest of them as well. He would have been like, I mean, probably a year older than you, or two.
I don't know when he. I think he was that little bit older than me, because, probably a year or two. I don't know when he was born. Yeah. I was born in 49, so
yeah. But he was like born. 16, 17 when they first.
Yeah.
But I said, this is the thing of when everything happened for you. Now, in the intervening years, there's been this whole culture of pop fame, especially where of kids becoming famous. But when it all happened for you, young people had only just started getting famous. There wasn't really, you know, you didn't really know what to do with, you know, there'd be, it'd probably start with Tommy Steele.
It was not an option. Yeah. You know, I often see interviews with kids today on telly where if people say, "What do you want to be?" So "I want to be famous."
Yeah.
Like it's a profession to be famous.
Yeah.
That didn't even enter our brains. I mean, I wanted to go to art school. I wanted to do, I loved making clothes, and I still do, actually. That's my hobby. And I wanted to go to art school and hopefully get into a fashion college and do fashion and design.
What was the clothes? You said you were a mod. So what were the clothes that you were wearing before, you know, you ended up being dressed by all the coutures in the world?
It was very much a uniform. I mean, I used to go to a club in... I was only allowed out on a Saturday night, quite rightly.
Quite right,
I mean,
quite right.
I was, yeah, quite right. My mum and dad were lovely. And I was not a rebellious teenager. I was, you know, dad said home at 10:30. I was home at 10:30. But we used to go to a mod club above Burton's Tailoring in Harrow-on-the-Hill. And we saw young people like Eric Clapton and and Georgie Fay.
What, they played there? They played there.
Yeah. Well, Eric was in the Yardbirds, I think. Who were the other ones in
Keith
the Yardbirds?
Keith Relf, Chris Drazier.
Was Jeff Beck in at the time?
Jeff came later.
Maybe I'm wrong, but I do remember Eric Clapton. Yeah. And Georgie Fame used to play
and
there.
And the Blue Flames.
Yeah, that's right. And the clothes were very specific. I mean, we were the young ones and we used to look at, they were like the older mods that we used to, every week, there was one girl particularly who was so stylish. And whatever she was wearing, we would try and copy in the week. So I got very busy for me and my friend Jennifer with my sewing machine trying to make things. And I remember one week, because we used to wear kind of, I mean, I must have looked like olive oil actually, because I had such skinny legs, and we wore a pleated grey skirt that we got. C&A was the big shop to shop at. There was one in Wembley, and we got a pleated grey skirt below the knee, hush puppy shoes. So you can imagine my legs with those. I must have looked hysterical. And little kind of jumpers with racing stripes across the top. And then we went one week dressed like that, because that's what she was dressed like. And she was in an ankle length A-line tweed skirt. And we thought, oh my goodness, where are we going to get that? So I went out after school on the Monday and bought some fabric, and I made myself and Jennifer, my friend, an A-line skirt, tweed to the ankle. Her mum forbade her to wear it. She thought it was disgusting.
Well, because you could see her, ankle.
Yes, I don't. Who knows? So we took her skirt on the bus, because we went to the club on the bus. We put her skirt in a brown paper bag, and we went upstairs. And when the bus was going, I hid her with my coat, and she took off whatever she was wearing and put on her long skirt.
Oh, my God. What was sort of slightly happening at that time, and in a way, the wave was forming, and you kind of fell into place just as it was kind of reaching its peak. Is there was a 20s revival, it seems to me, you know, like the 1920s kind of clothes, that stuff, skinny girls, you know, those, yeah, the kind of clothes you were describing.
Yeah, because
earlier.
Before me, I mean, Jean Shrimpton started it, really. If you look at Jean, I mean, she was so beautiful and much taller than me. But she was long and lanky, and she looked like, I always thought, like a kind of young foal with that long hair and the big eyes and those legs. And but before her, if you look at models, they were mainly kind of very aristocratic. Well,
it was grown up, wasn't it? It was all
very they were grown up.
Yeah.
And even girls in their late teens wanted to look like that. They looked older. And then in kind of the movie world, you had people like Monroe, who, although they were tiny, they were very shapely, which I weren't. So, you know, I didn't look anything like that. So when that whole thing happened to me, I thought they'd all gone mad, because I didn't look like that look. I was the complete opposite. But that's probably why what happened to me happened.
But there was that slight flapper kind of vibe.
Yeah.
Thoroughly
modern,
well. Millie. But also there's the thing of, because there'd been model, and like you said, there was Jean Shrimpton and stuff like that. But the thing of you being the actual centrepiece, you know, not being a clothes horse, which is kind of what a model is. It was about you, the person, right? It was you, the look.
Well, I think, again,
encapsulating a culture somehow.
It wasn't planned. Yeah. You can't plan something like that. But what happened when I went, it started out with me kind of just modelling. But I think because of the name, it kind of, and because what was happening in society about young people having a voice, young people having money, shops like Bieber, you know, Barbara Hulinicki, who created Bieber and changed our lives, because you could actually go out and buy a dress for £2. You know, suddenly the world was our oyster, not our mums and dads. It became, you know, it was very much about being young and all the bands coming up. I mean, it was an artist, Peter Blake and Alan Jones. It was like a revolution, actually.
And is that what it felt like to you, that you were part of the, you know, just
no,
like a
not, not when you're living it.
No, right.
When you're living it day to day. It was very exciting. And when that whole thing happened to me, I had to get permission to leave school. And my dad, bless him, who was a really lovely, I loved my dad. He was lovely. He was very gentle, very sensible, very down to earth. And he said to me, you know, you may be making a mistake, Leslie. You know, you don't know how much this is going to last, which he was right. You know, it could have lasted for 3 months. But he said, if I don't give you the permission to do this, you might end up hating me, which I wouldn't because I loved him so much. But it was very wise of him because had he stopped me, I might have regretted or held it against him for not letting me go. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, I mean, the other thing that was happening, of course, was the rise of working class people.
And yeah, there
was
exactly.
I mean, if you look at David Bailey in 65, the year before you took off, the boxer pinups that he did and who was in that, you know, this was the craze, you know, obviously John and Paul and, you know, there were lots of working class people in there, you know.
But what was funny was all the actors who sounded posh were the working class ones.
Well, if you talk to Michael, lovely Michael Caine, if you look at his first big film, which was Zulu,
that's right. And he plays
this talking
top
with
gen.
A posh accent. Yeah. Because that's what you had to do then. But then what happened when the whole thing, working class thing kicked in, you got the posh actors later on breaking down their accent so that it didn't sound posh because it was more fashionable to be working class.
Because people forget how difficult it was to be working class. I mean, you didn't ever aspire to thinking, I'm going to have a beautiful home in Kensington or whatever.
Never. And that's why I didn't. I had a distant inner dream of being a model and that, but no, it wasn't a reality. Of course not. Because girls like me didn't go to modelling school and didn't, you know, it wasn't even an option.
But so much of that is that post-war Labour consensus, isn't it? That's with all the bands, but working class kids going to art school and stuff and getting,
and
basically a lot of it is just getting a confidence which would never have been available to them.
Absolutely.
Before, you know. Yeah, it's brilliant. Well, you know, as and of course, now the ladder's been pulled up again, and you know, so
it's a revolution.
But
of course, you don't know when you're in it; you're just in it, right?
No, you don't. And it didn't really explode for me until I was taken over to America, and then it just. Then what happened? I went over as a model to work, and because of my name and. The thing that happened to me, I suddenly was on the Johnny Carson show, the Merv Griffiths show. You know, you become a celebrity.
But we're going to get to that.
We're going to get to that. Yeah. Well,
no, because
there's a real beef we got with that.
Just this bit on class. It's where you and being slightly embarrassed about being working class is when you get blokes called Nigel Davis calling themselves Justin de Villeneuve, right?
Exactly.
I loved because I didn't realise with Justin is his original name was Christian Saint Forget. Yeah. Is that right?
Yeah, well, his real name was Nigel Davis. He became
Christian Saint Forget.
Because I don't know how much you'd like to dwell on this, Twiggy, because from sort of his account of things, I don't know.
I don't go there.
I'll tell you that now.
Nope.
Okay. All right.
And if you want to find out about it, you've got to go and see our play Close Up.
Oh.
And that's my side of the story.
Regardless, obviously he was someone who was there for you at the beginning. You got to know him through his brother or something, didn't you?
Yeah, my sister, I had a Saturday job in a hairdresser's in Queensway, and his brother worked there in the barber's downstairs, and he used to come and meet his brother. And, you know, I mean, obviously we were together for 8 years, I think, and the beginning... You know, he was always there, and he did look after me. I mean, I think in a way, because I've just watched, they've done a series of, oh God, horrible stories of young models in the 80s being, you know, taken to Italy and Paris and, you know, basically being pimped out to businessmen. Horrible. I don't know whether you've watched them, but they're quite worrying. And none of that happened to me because, again, good old dad, my dad, said if I was going to do the modelling, you know, I was just 16 when it happened, he said that Justin would have to go with me or mum or dad would have. He wouldn't let me go to a studio on my own. So I never had a so-called Me Too moment ever.
Yeah.
And I think that was because I was so protected, mainly because my dad insisted.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
This message comes from BOF sponsor eBay. You'll know real when you get it. It'll say eBay Authenticity Guarantee. And you'll feel it. Maybe it's a head-turning handbag, a watch that says it all, jewelry that makes you look like the gem, or sneakers and streetwear so fresh every step feels fly. eBay gets it. So look for the blue check mark next to that thing you love and be confident that every inch, stitch, sole, and logo is checked by experts. With eBay Authenticity Guarantee, you can trust that feeling of real is always in reach. Ensure your next purchase is the real deal. Visit ebay.com for terms.
And how much was Mary Quant an inspiration and what was going on?
Barbara Hulanicki was my inspiration. Oh, I wore Mary's clothes because I was a model. As a model, you don't pick what you wear.
Yeah.
The magazines book you and they put you in clothes. And obviously Mary was huge and she had a lot to do with changing how young people dressed. But her clothes were quite high end. Barbara gave every working class girl the chance to dress, and her clothes were just amazing. I became obsessed. She then became one of my best friends and still is.
You had your own massive line, didn't you, of clothes?
I did.
Yeah.
Till we realised we were being totally ripped off.
But how hands on were you with that? Were you actually?
Totally. Yeah. Everything I've ever done in my career, I'm always completely. If you ever get to know me, I'm quite bossy. So if I get involved in something, it's because it's a passion. And I still make clothes. I love it myself. And I make curtains and bedspread. I love it. It's a passion. So
can I just give you one little insight? Because back in the 60s, because my I was sort of peripheral as a little kid, because my dad was an actor. My mum used to make shirts for bands and stuff. She worked with a girl.
Oh, did she?
Brilliant. She worked with a girl called Bambi, and they called themselves Bambi and Tessa, and they were known as Bait, which was meant to be a riposte to Mr. Fish.
Oh, lovely Michael Fish.
Yeah. Very, good.
Very good. Yeah, did you feel that in a way, Swinging London was taken away from you? Because you, when it happened, you were so much part of it. But of course, you couldn't enjoy it in a way. You were it. You were the centre of it. We all look.
but you don't think that when you're living it. I had a great life. I mean, I was travelling the world. I was going to Italy. I was going to Paris. New York was major. And then in 68, I went to Japan, and that was insane. You know, I went to a thing, and there were all these little Japanese girls dressed up as me, which was hysterical. Wow.
And they would have done it so accurately.
Oh, they were brilliant. It was brilliant. But I did get mobbed at the airport in Tokyo, and I burst into tears. So all the pictures of me in the Japanese newspapers that next day was me crying.
Oh my God. So the next day, all these girls were walking around dressed like you, crying.
Yeah. No. I was really young. It was weird.
Well, that's the thing, because the States is the first big trip. You arrive to this sort of, and it's to this sort of Beatlemania,
I did arrive to.
The New Yorker did 100 pages on it.
Did they?
Apparently, 100. I didn't even know the New Yorker was 100 pages long. I guess when you gather it all up, maybe, but it was quite extraordinary. I mean, I've seen the footage of it.
Yeah.
But Bert Stern, I don't know whether you know who that is.
He took the Marilyn Monroe pictures.
Yeah, he's one of the great photographers of that generation. It was Bert Stern, Richard Avedon, Irving Penn. They were the greats. And my first trip, age 17, to New York, courtesy of Diana Vreeland, who was the editress of American Vogue. So she was the queen of fashion. You know, American Vogue is the pinnacle. And suddenly, age 17, having modelled for a year in England and Paris, I was ordered to New York, and I was booked to work with Richard Avedon and Bert Stern. So you can't kind of top that. It was
What was Avedon like? What was he like?
Avedon, Oh, absolutely amazing.
I can imagine.
Absolutely amazing, man. Very, he was very tiny. He was very, he was like a pixie. And he was very intense, but very sweet. We only had one falling out because I came in one day to do a photograph and he took amazing photos. He was the first one who kind of took pictures of me. And I was only 17, but I'd always been doing pictures in London that I was a little teenage girl with pigeon toes and skinny legs. And he photographed me more as a woman. They're very beautiful, his photographs of me. I'm young, but they're not cooky and cute. Mm-hmm. They're very beautiful photographs.
I was, they became a huge thing in the 90s. Those psychedelic pictures he did of the Beatles, yeah. Those four portraits,
yeah,
which were actually for Dee Stern, weren't they? They were for a German magazine originally.
I don't know, no, but he did four of me for American Vogue like that. He did spring, summer, autumn, winter. And actually many years later, there's the autumn one is, I mean, it's a wig, but is a picture of me with this hair flying over my head. An amazing photograph. And because he was the first to do pictures of girls leaping in the air and things like that.
I guess that was partly technology. The cameras were able to capture.
I don't know, because technically I'm rubbish, but he had his assistant.
They were taking pictures of goalies before then, weren't they?
Spot the ball. Spot the ball.
His assistant used to hold. He'd tell me what he said, I want you to come in on the paper, which is hung down in the studio, and then leap up into the air. And his assistant, usually the umbrella where the light is static, and his assistant would hold the pole with the light and follow me over. So I was always lit, if you see what I mean.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, it was a new technique. It was amazing.
Wasn't Bruce, Stern was making a film of you as well, wasn't he?
So when I arrived in New York to do the shoot with Dick Avedon, Bert Stern, I think it was NBC. I'm not sure. It was either NBC or CBS. I can't remember. Commissioned Bert to shoot a documentary on my trip. And and that's kind of where I nearly got squashed to death by a crowd. I came out of a department store doing a photograph, and a crowd had gathered, and a crowd draws a crowd. I think half the people didn't even know who was there, quite honestly.
There's some old bloke who's going, I only give this a few weeks, it'll be over.
Exactly. That's in the film. they stop a couple of teenage girls who say, oh, she's so cute, I said, Twiggy, oh, yeah, we love her. But it's funny because you look at their clothes and they're still, because they were that much behind us in America, they're still in knee length. They look like Jackie Kennedy. They've got knee length skirts, little pillbox hats, and bags. And there's me in my mini skirt and my eyelashes. And they stop these girls who are, they're all excited. And then they stop this middle aged couple. He's got his hat on and his gabardine raincoat tied up. And he said, oh, yeah, she's cute. She'll last a couple of weeks. That was in 1967.
And then what bright spark had the idea of getting Woody Allen involved?
Oh, my God.
That was Bert.
That was Bert. Because, that's interesting, shameful for him.
Horrible behaviour.
What's interesting, it's just, we've just closed, actually, but Ben Elton has written this musical based on what happened to me, and that clip of Woody Allen interviewing me is in there. And every night, it's hysterical. When it finishes, it gets a row. I get a row from 1967. Wow.
Just explain to people what happens in that clip.
Well, you need to see it, really, but it's Bert said to me, there's this new young comic.
And he was a nightclub comic then, wasn't he?
He wasn't a big famous.
Yeah, he wasn't.
Yeah, yeah, he wasn't. This is 1967, he wasn't. I'd never heard of it. And he wasn't famous, except within the clubs. And he was up and coming as a comic. And Bert said, I want to put you in the studio with this guy. I'm going to get him to interview you because it would be fun. And I was used to being interviewed and people saying, how did you get your name and where did you grow up? The normal.
Oh, they're all my questions.
Damn.
All right.
Do you like New York? What's your favourite thing? Whatever. So I sit there, I was open for anything. And his first question was, what are your thoughts on Serious Matters? And I was like, oh my, you can see him. I mean, it gets around in the theatre. It's so funny.
Then he asks you what your favourite philosopher is.
Were there, yeah.
Oh my God.
And then I said, I don't know any, but he said, oh, everyone's got a favourite philosopher. And I said, who? Because I was panic stricken because I didn't. And he couldn't come up with any. And then in the end, he kind of.
No, but then you got him on Dickens, though, didn't you, eh? But
you need to see it.
You do need to see it. Although, there's so many things one could say in your defense. But one is, it's just the fact that you are 17. If you ask Woody Allen when he was 17, who was his favorite philosopher? You know what I mean?
It's like, I just
if
think
you were at school, you'd have just started your A levels. You know,
I don't even think that's the point. I just think if me at my age now, my ancient age now, if I'm suddenly have to interview some wonderful new young person, you don't do that to them. It's a horrible thing to do.
I tell you what was going on. And anyway, I tell you what was going on. It. Seriously. And I think it goes back to us talking about the class situation, the class divide and all of that, and the surprising rise of the working classes. That wasn't happening in America. There were no working classes rising up. You know, and I think it was, let's catch this stupid working class kid out.
Yeah,
and
and
it was a middle class trap. And I was disgusted when I saw it. But you did get him, because when you asked him what his favourite philosophers was, he couldn't name any.
I think, well, there's also an element. You've got to remember that you're the last in a series of cultural things that have just turned out. We've been kicking America's ass for a few years by this point. We've been giving them the Beatles. We've been giving them the whole British invasion.
Stones,
you turn up. It's like, you know, we got everything. What you got?
Yeah, and also there was this other thing about, well, models are all airheads. That was the other thing.
Exactly. Yeah. But that's been going on for years. I think it's kind of changed. Well, maybe not. You can't be, you know, you can't be attractive and be intelligent, which is a load of old codswallopers. Many, many wonderful models, actresses have proved all the way through.
There were models of you, literally models, tiny model. You could buy merchandise of Twiggy.
Yeah, I think in America anyway, the Beatles were the first big merchandise thing. And then the Twiggy doll came out in 67, 68.
And was Justin and your dad keeping an eye on this? Were you getting money from it?
Yeah, but we got ripped off left, right. You know, we were so... It was new. Things like that hadn't happened before. We got paid. But when you look back at what we should have earned, what I should have earned, you know...
But there's always that thing of you know, people saying, oh, it's getting ripped off or whatever. But you're
and
not a business person. That's not what you've done. You haven't set out
but also
to sort of
that
make
in the...
a box and sell it, you know.
You know, we did get paid, but we didn't get paid when you look back what we should have paid. But you know, in the recording world, it was even worse from what I can understand in, you know, the record business. I know so many. Do you remember a wonderful artist called Tim Harding?
Oh, yeah.
Who became a friend, funnily enough, before he died. He's sweet, lovely. And he wrote beautiful songs. You know, Lady Came from Baltimore and A Reason to Believe. I mean, amazing songs. Mm. He was always broke. He got completely ripped off. Somebody got him to sign something when he probably had a few drinks and he didn't realise what he was signing. He didn't have the rights to any of those songs. It's so awful.
Well, a lot of those artists tend to be tight right now, even to this day, don't they? Because they grew up in austerity as well. And never quite
sure.
But it's also, you know, I mean, the book was being written on all this stuff. I mean, who knew what a publishing deal was? Who knew what a good deal was?
Exactly.
You know,
you know,
the Beatles' first deal was 50-50. Their publisher got 50% for doing what?
I know.
Did you always have an ambition to take it further and to do acting and singing?
Yeah, I never even thought about it. You know, when you're that age, I don't know whether, you know, it's hard to remember what I thought then, but... My memory, no, I loved modelling. I was travelling the world. I was happy. I had enough money to buy my Bieber dresses. And, you know, it was great. And, you know, I was working for the best magazines in the world. And so I didn't even think, I think somebody showed me an old interview with, I think
Michael Parkinson, and he says to me, would you like to go into acting? And I go, oh, no.
God,
and
wow.
So it was when Ken Russell approached me, it wasn't actually to do The Boyfriend, the film I did with him. It was to do another film that never happened. Uh-huh. But that was because I was training to do The Boyfriend, which was his film after The
Dome. But he was a friend of yours, wasn't he, anyway?
Well, he became a friend. I met him about this other film that didn't happen, which was based on a famous book, which was about a magician who travels the world with a young, very young girl. And he wanted me to play the girl. And he wanted Paul McCartney to do the music. And that's how I met Paul, because I had a lunch with Ken about this project and Paul was there, which was really weird. Paul and I laugh about it now because we're old friends now, from that day. Because he was like my favourite Beatle. So suddenly, 3 years before, I'd been one of the screaming girls at Finsbury Park.
Yeah. And, you saw them play?
Yeah. Oh, but you couldn't hear them. No. You could only see them.
Is that the Finsbury Park Astoria, would that have been?
Yeah.
The Rainbow.
The Rainbow,
yeah. And so I was probably about 14, 13. But you couldn't hear anything they were doing. You could just see them because we were making so much.
They didn't have PAs. They had nothing. They gave up. They had tiny little speakers at the side of the stage.
But then you're having tea with him.
Yeah. So I was really nervous because he was like my idol. It was like, how do I not embarrass myself? We laugh about it anyway. But and we became friends. But anyway, that didn't happen.
And he with Jane at that point?
Yeah, he was. Yeah. And we had dinners and things. But then the Boyfriend idea came up because I'd been to see it on stage, the revival, and I was telling Ken about it. And he's one night at dinner after a few champagne said, oh, let's do a film of it. You can play Polly Brown, which is the girl in it. Yeah. And I'll direct it. I've always wanted to do a musical. And I thought, forget about it. Because, you've got to remember, he was the biggest director in England at that point.
And you went to screenings. Huge. You went to screenings at his house, didn't you, of other movies? Yeah. That was a regular thing.
That year before we shot it, he would have screenings every Friday night of all the Busby Barclay movies. Oh. Fantastic. And all the Fred and Ginger movies, because he wanted me to kind of get in that kind of period era, because it's set in the 20s.
Because this is the thing.
And it was a big learning curve.
Well, I was going to say, because you're not, I mean, you said earlier, like, do you want to act? No, not really. But then not only do you act, you take your first thing as this starring role, and it's all the disciplines. It's singing, acting, and dancing. So,
I wasn't nervous about the singing, because I knew I could sing. And I loved that period thing, that, all those... Ruth Etting and Elsie Carlisle and Bing Crosby, all those people. I love that era of music. So that didn't throw me so much, but the dancing was scary. So I went off to, it was basically tap dancing and I'd never done it. So he sent me off to class and I did a year learning to tap. And I learned enough to do for the film, but I learned much more afterwards under the tuition of Tommy Tune, who I ended up doing the big Broadway show on.
That's a lovely drawn-out thing, isn't it? How that comes back, how you brought him in. Yeah. And that's really, really sweet relationship. Yeah.
Well, I got him cast in The Boyfriend because Ken wouldn't fly. He had a phobia about flying.
And like one Kubrick.
Oh, really?
Kubrick was the same. That's why everything was shot in England.
Yeah. Ken wouldn't fly. And he wanted to cast an American dancer in the American role. He didn't want an English person doing an American. And I'd just come back from a shoot in New York and seen Tommy on TV. He was performing and choreographing a big variety show. And this creature, I don't know whether you know what, or the audience know what Tommy looks like, but he's 6 foot six. Yeah. He was one of the most extraordinary things I've ever seen. These legs that just danced amazingly, and he was so amazing looking. He's half American Indian, so he had long black hair, very, very handsome, 6 foot six, and tap dancing. I mean, what are you want?
I know.
So I said to Ken, oh my God, I've seen this guy, you've got to. So Ken, there was no internet, so he got somebody to in New York to mail a video thing, though, so that Ken could see him of the show, and he cast him on the spot.
Yeah, and it was a sort of done as a play within a play, wasn't it? Because I have to tell you, I know that play intimately, because I'd never forget it. I did it when I was 16. I played Bobby Van Hoosen, albeit at school.
Yeah. Everyone did. Lee, you know, I'm married to, you know. He played Tony. It wasn't amateur, but it was, repertory.
Yeah.
I think every young actor has done.
But you
it
fitted it perfectly, because there's this 20s revival going on, and you've got that look. Those eyes. I mean, you did have that 20s look. I mean, we didn't mention it earlier, but you had a particular skill with painting on your eyelashes.
Oh yes.
I just did. That was me just playing around with my eye makeup. You know, all teenage girls muck around with makeup. If any of you have got teenage daughters, I'm sure, you know, Saturday afternoon, they usually sit there doing...
No, Guy and I are all boys. We're all boys. I have four.
Oh, you've all got boys?
Yeah.
Oh, you miss the teenage girl thing, which is a bit scary, really, I suppose. But girls do muck around with makeup, you know. So I was just playing around one day, and, you know, and then as a mod, the whole thing, we kind of blanked out our lips with pan stick. It was all about the eyes.
But it was because it was quite androgynous, the mod thing, wasn't it?
Yeah.
But anyway, going back to the boyfriend, you got two Golden Globes, did you, for that? Is that right?
Yeah, because the idea of it is this is because, this brilliant idea of setting, of it being someone trying to do the boyfriend.
Yeah.
Is that because Ken thought there wasn't quite enough?
He quite rightly, because if you know the boyfriend, which not everyone will, but it's a pastiche on the 1920s, right, Gary?
Yeah.
It's kind of it's almost like a very fond send up of that period.
Because I think it's written in the 50s, isn't it?
Sorry,
it's written in the 50s.
Sandy Wilson wrote it in the 50s, and it's his homage to the 20s, and it's quite camp, and it works on stage brilliantly, and you're taken into this little world. Ken believed, and I think he was right, because they tried to make it many times. Julie Andrews was going to do it when she was young enough to do it, because you had to be, you know, the opening song is I'm 17 or thereabout, so you've got to be young to do it. And there were many scripts written, and it never got made for whatever reason. And Ken had this idea of it being a rather naff repertory company putting on a production of The Boyfriend in a rather tatty theatre, which we shot in Portsmouth at the Theatre Royal. So you got all the backstage stuff as well, which I thought was a brilliant idea.
We have to bring David Bowie into the conversation.
Ah, yes.
Because that pin-ups cover is absolutely extraordinary. Could you just talk us through how that happened? Because that wasn't going to be a cover at first.
No,
was
it was going to be, it was shot for the cover of English Vogue. And I didn't know David at that point. This must have been, when did it come
72,
out?
72. 73.
Yeah, something like that. So we must have shot it around 72. He was in Paris recording. And it was all done through English Vogue. He was huge. You know, I loved him. I thought he was extraordinary. You know, his music came out and it was so unlike anything we'd ever heard. He was, you know, such an...
Well, you got
talent.
Mentioned on the Aladdin Sane album, because
I did.
In Driving Saturday.
She sings like Twig the Wonder Kid. I was at home doing the washing up and I heard it. And I rushed out and bought it. I was like, oh my God, that's before I met him. But anyway, so I flew to Paris to do the shoot and for English Vogue, and they had a makeup artist. And because David always kind of, you know, dressed up and did, you know, that androgynous kind of thing, the makeup artist said, I want to paint these masks
Wasn't
on your face.
Who's the makeup artist? Pierre?
It was French. I can't remember the full name.
I know you mean.
And again, I don't think he's with us. Oh, you're looking it up. I can see.
Well, might as well.
Yeah, I'd love to remember, actually. Yeah. It was, he was lovely.
But,
yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, go on.
Anyway, he did the makeup where he kind of paints masks on our face. And we did the photograph and we had dinner with David that night. And such a sweet, lovely, bright man. And we kind of stayed in touch, but not, you know, he kind of moved to America,
but,
really.
Who was the photographer on that
why
day?
Wasn't it you? So it wasn't on the cover of Vogue. Right.
No. So hold on. Yeah. So we suddenly get a call from English Vogue saying the editor has looked at the photographs. He thinks they're gorgeous, but he won't put a man on the cover of Vogue.
That's what I was going to say, because I remember, because it was, the big deal is because the first man, if I'm correct, to be on the cover of Vogue was Brian Ferry with Jerry Hall in 1975.
Probably. Yeah, a bit later.
So that would have been a big deal. That would have been a really big deal if that picture had happened.
I said to the editor, you are insane. Bowie is the biggest thing in the UK. You will sell more copies of English Vogue than you've ever dreamed of because of him. And you won't put, no, I can't. And I said, also, we're wearing makeup. You can even credit him his makeup.
It was Pierre LaRoche.
Pierre
LaRoche, thank you. He was lovely. So they wouldn't budge. So while this argument was going on, David said to me, well, I'll put it on the cover of Pinups, which is the album he was recording. And actually, it's been brilliant because it's had a much longer life, because every time they re-release Pinups in different formats, it comes out again.
But that's such a lovely idea, isn't it? Sorry, Gary, because it's David's Pinups and he's with a Pinup on the...
So, and also it worked with the music, didn't it? Because the music was although it felt to me when I heard it as a kid that this music was from the ancient past, but it was only about 5 or 6 years old.
That's right,
it was the Who records and, you know, and Small Faces, etc. A bit of Pink Floyd, of course, Syd Barrett. Did you remain friends with him? Because you ended up doing a TV show with him much...
We did. I'm so terrible with years, but it must have been in the 70s sometime. I was booked to do Bing Crosby's Christmas special, which
Merry Old Christmas special. It was called The Merry Old.
And I was a guest, and David was a guest, and Stanley Baxter was a guest doing all the comedy. Stanley, it was brilliant. But they did it like a family Christmas in a big old, it was a set, but it was like meant to be a big old English house, and Bing and his family were in England for Christmas. And we shot it in the September, and I sang Have Yourself a Merry Little Christmas. I mean, I was so nervous because I'd done quite a lot of telly by then, because I'd had a couple of singles out. I'd had Here I Go Again. So I'd been on Top of the Pops where you sang live and everything. But sometimes you go on and sing to playback on TV because it was just easier and they got a better sound mix and everything. Well, when I came to do the song with Bing, I presumed we'd pre-record it and do it to playback, and Bing would not do that. He only sang live. So I said, oh my God, I've got to sing live with Bing Crosby. Wow. I was so nervous, but he was so sweet to me, and it's a really sweet recording, actually. It's so sweet.
And did you watch his singing with David? Were you there for that?
Little drummer boy.
I don't think I was there when they recorded it, but obviously I've seen it. And they released that as a single, as you know.
They never Your mum and dad. Oh, they never album. Look at each other.
Yeah, no. Your mum and dad must have been knocked out, because obviously Bing must have been one of their heroes,
absolutely.
Right?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. When my mum was so funny. You know, she was an ordinary kind of working class lady. When I introduced her once at some do to Sir Bernard Delfont, she curtsied.
Oh. And now you're a dame.
No, I'm a dad.
But actually, Guy, it's worth seeing that Bing Crosby special, because he starts off, he's in America and he gets a call from his brother who's got some pile in London, who lives there.
That's right.
And Stanley Baxter plays the sort of, you know, all of the servants that are there.
Oh, he's
and the butler.
And he plays the cook and everything. Yeah. Yeah. So
I always assumed it was an American thing. So was it an English thing?
No, but
it's all shot here. Right.
Shot here.
And then Stanley Baxter only existed at Christmas, didn't he? Right. He had this enormous special, and then he just went back to his cave or wherever for the rest of the year.
But then Bing goes into another room, and Charles Dickens, played by Ron Moody, is sitting
the
fire.
I've only seen the little clips. There's the whip. Because Will Ferrell, Will Ferrell reshot it with someone else. It might have been the guy who does that great actress, as well. But he reshot the scene where David comes in and talks to Bing Crosby. Do you remember?
Oh, did he?
And they reshot the whole thing, word for word, except for... It becomes a sort of slanging match at the end, but it's really. But they've done it exactly on YouTube. I think you find it on YouTube. I just came across it by accident once. Yeah,
my daughter loves Will Ferrell. Well, I love him. He makes me laugh. God.
So Twiggy, tell us about how you eventually end up going to Broadway and doing and getting a Tony nomination.
Just, I did.
Go talk us through that tale.
Because of my connection with Tommy after the boyfriend, you know, we became great, great, great buddies. And we would go, we tried to get another film going, like a Fred and Ginger film. And we couldn't, I can't remember now, but we couldn't raise the money, usual problems. So he went back to New York. This is in the early, mid-70s. I had 2 years training with him, tap dancing. That's why I got good enough to do the Broadway thing. Because he obviously is a great teacher. I never got quite to his level. But then, as he said, he's been tap dancing since he was 5.
Are you still in touch, by the way? Are you still in touch?
Yeah, we are, actually, yeah. I mean, not close, but, you know, Christmas and birthdays and things like that. And if I'm in New York, we have dinner and things. He went back to New York and became this massive Broadway director. He's got so many Tonys. I said, you've got so many Tonys, you can make a crown. Because he's probably got about 10 or 11. I mean, but his shows were fantastic.
He's tall enough. He's tall enough.
He's tall enough. And, but he wanted to get back to performing. So he had this idea. He wanted to do a kind of Broadway musical with Gershwin music, and he wanted me to co-star. So I remember him ringing me. This is in 82. So it's 10 years since we'd kind of worked together on the other thing. And he had the power to get that made because he was such a big director. He rang me and said, you know, I've got this idea. It's being written. It's going to be a story based around Gershwin. These wonderful Gershwin songs. And I can remember saying, I can't do that. And he said, there's no such, because the thought of going out live on a Broadway stage was so terrifying. And he said, there's no such word as can't, pack your bags and get on a flight to New York, which I did. And, you know, it was a massive hit.
God, what was
and
that was, press night like? You must have been absolutely terrified.
I had tonsillitis.
Oh, God. Oh, no. Course,
you know, and yeah. Tommy had put his back out, actually, because you know what happens when you're rehearsing.
Carrying his Tonys around. Carrying his Tonys around.
Yeah, carrying his Tonys around. But, you know, you work so hard to get the show on. You're a wreck by the time you open. But I'd had tonsillitis for a few days. The doctor gave me God knows what to get me through, you know, because it was, I had about 5 songs, I think, plus all the dancing. But anyway, well, we ran for 18 months and we got wonderful reviews.
And what was that like? Wow. So you, I mean, were you expecting to kind of have to basically move to New York for that long?
Well, you never know how long, do you? I mean, if you get in those days, they're not so powerful anymore because of the internet and people put reviews up before the reviewers. But in those days, the New York Times had such power, they can close a show overnight. So you never know until, but luckily they were very kind. We ran, we could have run longer. We did I was signed for 6 months, but because it was such a big hit, they then signed us on for another year, which I agreed to do.
And the one and only soundtrack is out there, right? The one and only soundtrack? Are you on that? Yeah.
I am. And then Tommy did, about 3 months after we finished in New York, which was 84, he then took it on the road. But I had a 5-6-year-old daughter. I couldn't go on the road. And I'd had enough. You know, that's a long time to do.
A long time?
But I loved it. It was for me, it's the thing I'm the most proud of because I didn't think I could do it.
Guy, do you know that Twiggy did a prog rock concept album concert? Do you know?
I did a what?
Did I miss this in my research?
Well, Roger Glover, Deep Purple.
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, that's
the Battle of My Ball.
Yeah,
why don't I know that?
No, she's not on the album. Right. You don't not on the album. Ah,
I don't know.
No, you played.
I did that. Played the fairy at the end, and I
at the Albert Hall.
At the Albert Hall.
Yeah, that was scary. But my first concert tour, I did a concert tour in the because my first album. Oh God, I'm so terrible on years. Probably came out in 73, 74, and I did.
Pardon? Gary will know. He's the Bill Frindle of the show. He's got all the stats.
And I did cut my first album because I'd become obsessed with country music because I'd been living in LA. And as you know, country is huge. And
and just, you know, their
like
voices.
Who? What?
Dolly Parton,
right.
Joni Mitchell,
yeah, because that
Nancy
was...
Griffiths, Glenn Campbell, no. Randy Travis. I mean, you know, there's so many. Mary Chapin Carpenter.
Where did you record the record?
In London.
Oh, you didn't go. You never did a Nashville trip.
I did go to Nashville and I recorded in Nashville, but I was between record companies and we did some demos, but they never got picked up. But it was quite extraordinary recording in Nashville. That would have been in the late 70s.
How was it?
Before I had gone. What, Nashville?
They shove you in. You've got like 3 hours to do a track, haven't you, from start to finish?
I don't remember that. Oh. I just remember it being amazing. And these amazing musicians, you know, guys doing slide guitar. No, yeah.
But I always think that because it is such an amazing production line in Nashville, I always think it's a bit like sort of a mini cab office with just sort of drivers
but
sitting
I think
around going,
it's
well, we've got Twiggy. who's up for that?
But I think it's become, I don't remember it being like that. When right. I mean, I'm talking about, the 70s. I think it was, Nashville was Nashville, but it was not what I think it's probably become.
No,
now.
What's funny now is the way the music business has changed is that now everyone's, it used to be, it was all country. And, you know, it was the country production line, all the country producers, country musicians. Now it's everyone. Everyone, no matter what type of music you do, I know some guys in a big German metal band, they've moved to Nashville. It's like, oh, it's true, everyone's in Nashville. It's really weird.
Have you thought of moving to Nashville, Guy? I would love that. Yeah. But, Twiggy, you're working with my ex-wife Sadie Frost, aren't you?
I am. Doing, lovely Sadie.
Because she did a Mary Quant documentary, and then
and that's how. I mean, I've known Sadie a little bit over the years. Like I've known you. You kind of meet people and you know them, but. I didn't know her, if you know what I mean. Like, I don't know you. Yeah. Well, I do now because you've done my podcast.
I have. I had a lovely cup of tea with you.
Yeah, my tea but was
right, so
heavy,
can I quote that? Twiggy
now,
says
actually.
You're a no-no, Gary.
No. Can you? So you're making a document. She's making a documentary about your life.
So
right?
Sadie's, when she did the Quant documentary, which was brilliant, I thought, the PR people came to me and said, could Sadie come on the podcast? I said, oh, I'd love it. That'd be brilliant. So in the podcast, we're chatting away and talking about Quant and everything. Somewhere in the podcast, she said to me, I said, oh, no, I asked her if she was going to do another documentary because, you know, I said, this is so good. You've got to do more. It's brilliant. And she said, yeah, she said, I'd love to do another one kind of based in the 60s because I love doing all the research and I love that period, blah, blah. And then she suddenly said, oh, I should do you. And that's how the idea came out.
And have you been discovering new archive?
I mean, I'd seen a lot of it, but there's a lot out there. You know, I've been around for a long time.
And then now you're a musical as well.
I am a musical, yeah. That's
I
been
am a musical.
Well, working with Sadie has been wonderful. And we're in the middle of it, as you know. I doubt if it'll come out much before the end of next year, but she's doing a wonderful job and I love, we just get on, we work together really well. And then the musical came up before that, actually. Ben Elton, who's been a close friend for, 15 years, something like that. We were having dinner about 3 years ago, 4 years ago. And I don't know whether you know, but anyone can do your life story, which is a bit scary, really. And I was always nervous somebody was going to, you know, go out and do either a TV or a, you know, a stage show, you know, without.
Well, that's true. If you're a musician or, you know, you could say, well, you're not allowed to use my music.
That's the thing. Where you get things like that Hendrix movie, don't you? Which is
with you, it was different. They could, anyone could do
you
it.
You can't stop somebody. And I know that because years ago, Jackie Onassis, you know, who was pretty powerful. She'd been married to the president and she was married to him. They did a documentary, a docudrama on her life. No, it wasn't a doc. It was a drama with Natalie Portman being brilliant. Actually, it's a good series. She tried to stop it and she couldn't.
Right.
Which I find amazing that she couldn't. Anyway, so I always had that in the back of my mind because over the years we've had people approach us and it hasn't happened, you know, usual thing. And so we were talking about this with Ben and he said, well, I should do it. And I said, really? And he said, I should do it. I'm gonna go, because he's so clever, Ben. I mean, he's always writing books and writing Siri, and he you know, in the summer he was doing We Will Rock You Again. So he went off to write, and in like a year and a half ago, he was having a meeting with David Babani, who runs the Chocolate Factory, the Chocolate Factory. I'm sure you do. And it's a wonderful fringe theatre in London.
In fact, I saw Gary in a play there. You were in Snoo Wilson's Pig Night there, weren't you?
That's right.
Well, there you go. It's wonderful. And what Davey's done is amazing. Anyway, Ben went to see him about another project for the Chocolate Factory, and Davey didn't like it. And he said, have you got anything else? And Ben said, well, I'm writing this thing with and about Twiggy. And he said, I'll do it. So he commissioned him to do it as a musical.
And is it a jukebox musical? Is all the music... Yeah. So what kind of songs are in there?
There's everything from covers When My Mum and Dad Met. So there's a couple of 30s songs in it.
All right.
And then it goes... Obviously, there's some good 60s. But he had to pick songs that fit the storyline.
Lyrically. So have you got sort of songs from The Boyfriend, for instance? Or
no. The interesting fact, and we have an actor playing Melvin Bragg brilliantly, who comes on to introduce The Boyfriend and tells the story, which is true. He said the reason we haven't got any songs from The Boyfriend for this show, Sandy Wilson hated Ken's film so much, which we all knew. He hated the film, the man who wrote it, wrote the play, that his estate will not allow even to... Now, 50 years later, will not allow any music to be used. So they found a kind of 20s boyfriend type song, which we use in the piece, but it's quite funny.
Wow.
So we thought Ben wanted to put that in.
Well, what's the hopes for it? Is it going to carry
on? We ran, because, you know, it's the Chocolate Factory, you only run for 8-10 weeks, something like that. We just closed on Saturday. So I feel kind of slightly sad now, because we were going in once a week. I love my cast so much. And we've been so involved. You know what it's like when you put...
Who plays you, Twiggy? I mean,
a beautiful, lovely, talented girl called Eleanor Skye. And her voice just... She was in We Will Rock You, the one in the summer, playing Scaramouche. She's got the most amazing voice. And she's kind of, I mean, with the wig and the eyelash in the, you know, on stage, she captured me. It was brilliant. And
is it going to go on tour? You hope it's going to go on tour.
That's the hope. Yeah, we can't make any announcements yet.
Up west.
We hope so. Right. And then Broadway and the world, love. I don't know.
More Tonys through your surrogate. It's been lovely having you on, Twiggy.
Well, thank you.
Absolute honour and a delight to meet you, Twiggy.
It's been lovely. I mean, we could chat forever and ever and ever. Thank you very much. Yeah, and tune in to my podcast, please, everyone. Tea with Twiggy. Gary's on at the moment.
I am.
You're chatting away to me.
It was lovely. See you soon.
Yeah, lots of love.
Well, that was great, wasn't it, Gary?
Yeah. She's such a nice person, isn't she? But given what she's done, I mean, massive national treasure and an icon of the 60s, and yet so down to earth.
Yeah, but what I really like is the fact that that was a bit different to what we usually do. But the fact that the thing about this podcast is yes, we're about music, but we're about music that comes from a culture, you know, and she was such a key part of that culture of the 60s.
And you never thought I'd say prog, did you?
I didn't. I knew, but yeah, you managed to get it in there. I've got to say, I thought I had a slam dunk with that line from the Blues Brothers, and it's to my great shame that she didn't remember.
You threw her. I think she just was completely thrown by your... You remember these great lines, don't you? You love movies, don't you?
I do, so yeah.
Anyway, look, whatever.
Yeah,
it was great having Twiggy on, and just, you know, feel like we've achieved something quite great by reaching out, expanding our normal portfolio.
Exactly. Do you know what I did want to ask her about? I wonder if... Because, you know, it's a film that we both love, which is Ken Russell's very first film, which is A House in Bayswater.
Oh, yeah, of course. A House in Bayswater.
Which we'd recommend to any of our listeners.
It's a documentary about A House in Bayswater, isn't it?
Yeah, and it's all about the changing faces. And it's unbelievable. And it's like when... it's like 1962, and it's actually the road next to the road I used to live on, off Notting Hill Gate.
Anyway, thank you so much for listening this week to Twiggy and us. And thank you to Ben Jones for producing this episode for Gimme Sugar. Anything else?
No, I think that's it. That was very neat, Gary. Very tidy. So it's good night from me.
Good night from him.
Rock on Tours is produced by Gimme Sugar Productions for Warner Music Group UK.
This message comes from BOF sponsor eBay. You'll know real when you get it. It'll say eBay Authenticity Guarantee. And you'll feel it. Maybe it's a head-turning handbag, a watch that says it all, jewelry that makes you look like the gem, or sneakers and streetwear so fresh every step feels fly. eBay gets it. So look for the blue check mark next to that thing you love and be confident that every inch, stitch, sole, and logo is checked by experts. With eBay Authenticity Guarantee, you can trust that feeling of real is always in reach. Ensure your next purchase is the real deal. Visit ebay.com for terms.